Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, welcome to the show. This is the Pop Rocks Radio Talk Show. I'm your host, Pop Art Banner Jamie Rocks, and this is the big show. You found it. I sure am glad you did. Hey, it's a Friday. It's a Friday, and I'm still an old computer heck. Now, I'm supposed to have my new computer today. I'm kind of disappointed about that. We're getting one specifically for the show and whatnot. Just makes it a lot easier to do. Hook up some power, baby. But apparently, I don't know what happened, but apparently, everybody on the planet Earth has ordered computers, and it screwed up the whole computer, getting the power computer to me. So hopefully that'll be resolved here in a couple days, and, you know, we'll be great. The show goes on, though. The show goes on. I still have this one. I just have to baby it a little bit. That's all. I can't have 27 tabs open at one time. So, you know, you do what you got to do. First world problems and all that. We're going to be starting today's episode very shortly. We're just waiting for for the talent to call in. No, that's what they call it in the business, you know. It's very true. Very true. So we're going to be doing that. We'll play a track until that happens. And I know he's calling in. Sam's awesome. And so we're going to play, this is a band that was on the show a couple weeks ago. Oh, really? A month or two ago. Called Crimson Apple. They're out of L.A. They're a group of four sisters, and they are just cool, turned up to 10. This is Can't Get Out of Bed.
I can't get out of bed. Tangled in sheets, life it weighs me down. I heard the things you say, but how could you know?
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. This is the Pop Rocks Radio Talk Show. I'm your host, pop art painter Jamie Rocks, and this is the big show. You found it. I sure am glad you did. I am very, very excited. It's a Friday. Well, you know, that doesn't excite me anymore at all because, you know, a Friday is just like a Tuesday. And, you know, it's the world has shifted, and that's fine as long as we're all, you know, we can put up with that and be safe and secure and all that, and everything's good. And I hope you guys listening and tuning in are all of those things. But it is a Friday if you just need the reminder. If you're listening to our live show here, what I'm really excited about is we finally are doing this show. This show's been scheduled and moved twice, not because of our guests, all because of me and our host servers in New York City. And everybody knows how those host servers in New York City can be. Oh, my gosh. Anyway, I would like to welcome a fantastic filmmaker, Mr. Samuel Farmer. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
Samuel, how are you?
Thanks so much for having me. I'm doing all right.
Absolutely.
Sheltering in place.
Fantastic. Now, which area of the country are you in? Are you in L.A. or are you here back east? Where are you at?
East Coast. I'm here in Florida. The outbreak is it's mostly in Miami-Dade. We've been spared up in North Florida, but you know, recently a series of photos made the rounds because the Jacksonville Beach decided to open up, and it made national headlines because people flock to the beaches at different times of the day. And it was weird.
I'm in South Florida, so yeah, I'm down here where all the zaniness is going on, and it's, you know, it's weird because now I have friends. I visited some friends. Oh gosh, it's been a while. It's been years now, but I really they lived in Jacksonville Beach, and I really liked that. That's a nice area, man. That's a nice beach. That really sold me on Florida when I was visiting there, and I was down at the beach. Watching the cats do the windsurfing, you know, with the big pair of tight things on, and I'm like, man, this is for me. This is pretty nice.
We're here in the hipster heart of the city.
No, I got you.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I went to one of my first. What the hell's the name of that pizza place? I don't know, mushroom pizza or something. Anyway, we were having pizza at this kind of hippie hipster type place. It's all painted crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody thought they saw a UFO. And so we all went out in the park. This really happened, ladies and gentlemen. Somebody came in the restaurant, and they're like, hey, there's a UFO up in the sky. And we all got up, the whole restaurant, went out to the parking lot, and it was a plane. But he was having a good time, and we all patted him on the back and said better luck next time and went back and ate our pizza. It was great.
That sounds like Jacksonville.
Fun times, man. I'm telling you.
I can confirm. Yes. Just as any good old boys. You think you live in a Navy town and you've got two different airfields in here that receive military aircraft, that people would be a little bit more skeptical about what flies overhead since it's constant.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Now there's plenty of good old boys around here that apparently skipped a grade or two or maybe dropped out altogether.
Well, who knows? You know, I was kind of hoping he was right. You know, I'm one of those people that are like, really? Let's talk
everybody.
To him.
Yeah, you want
to
rush outside and assume, but yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely cool. I'm one of those people in the really funny UFO movies that will run and try to talk to them, and then you find out in the movie that they're evil aliens and they disintegrate me. I'm one of the guys that would get disintegrated. You know, I'm definitely.
Well, you got close
encounters,
right?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what you think. Or even with ghost movies and stuff, I would be the guys in the library of Ghostbusters. Get her. And then she turns into a monster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's me. That's me. Now, hey, let me ask you. You grew up in Jacksonville there, that area?
Yes. Yeah, grew up in Jacksonville.
Oh, cool.
And it's, I guess, it is what it is.
Well, hey, man. You know, it beats every place. You know, it's funny, no matter where you go. I'm an old man now, but I remember, you know, I've lived everywhere, man. I'm like that Johnny Cash song. I've been everywhere, man. Everywhere you go and you talk, especially young people, they're like, oh, I got to get out of this place. this place. I bet you there are cats in Dubai, you know, living in the city of the future going, well, this place is just too futuristic for me. I need to go, you know, wander the desert. I got to get out of here. No kid, no youngsters are ever pleased where they're at, no matter how nice it is or bad.
Yeah. That's absolutely true.
You know, it's just one of them things. Now, were you always a film guy, though? Were you always, like, making movies and stuff? Or is filmmaking, did that come about recently? Or what's that story like?
I had an interest, I think, in my teenage years, my early teenage years. I started making stop-motion videos. That's where it began. Yeah, I always had some interest in the arts. My my grandmother facilitated that when I was younger. I was drawing and painting, and got into ceramics and sculpture and stuff like that. And I seemed to be on that track. And then I discovered that we had a video camera in the house, and realized this wasn't like proper stop motion where you can do a frame a second, you know, capture a single frame. I just figured out how long it took for the tape to begin actually recording. Like, I had a count when I pressed the button, it took this long for the tape heads to spin up. And then if I press stop, I'd get a frame or two at a time. So I got pretty good at it just by doing it so much. And then, that graduated to what I think everyone does with the camera. In their teenage years, you and your friends are skating and making skating videos, and then eventually someone decides to reenact something from Cops. And so most of your early films are you just pretending to be cops and chasing your friends around the neighborhood. But at some point I got serious about it and started trying to figure out how to edit, how to light things. But I was too lazy to ever, or too distracted, I think, to ever take an actual class on it. So I had a longer road towards filmmaking just out of pure, I think, stubbornness.
I gotcha. Well, here you are, Annette, man. You know, regardless, you're dropping a feature film in a week. You know, maybe two.
Yeah,
it's coming right up.
It was 11.
What is it,
11
May?
May 5th is when the film drops here.
May 5th.
Yep.
How cool is that? How cool
is that? It's pretty exciting.
I've
been sitting on it for almost 2 years.
That's amazing. That is amazing. That is so cool. I see right here on the Facebook page for Cry for the Bad Man, which is the movie, ladies and gentlemen, there is an Amazon link where you can pre-order the DVD and whatnot. I'll be posting that up on my social media and blasting that out right after the show and everything. So just hold tight, ladies and gentlemen. You'll be able to pre-order this and have it before anybody. How about that? Very, very cool. And come on, Samuel. Come on. I hear your phone. Look at you. You're big shot time now. This is big time Hollywood. That's pretty cool.
Well, it's still low budget filmmaking. We had a very modest budget that we raised ourselves, and we had a small crew, but that's good because there's more, you know, freedom to have it your way. We just lucked out getting Camille involved because she's a friend of a friend. And it doesn't feel big time. We're all still working our day jobs, which we all work in production anyway. So, you know, when we stopped making a movie, we went back to making commercials. So,
I got
of course, right now we're all working from home, obviously.
Which is crazy. But, you know, it's so cool. You know, I paint pictures for a living. It's what I do for a living. And I'm not in the movie business, but I'm a movie nut. I'm the guy with the studio in his backyard, and I make my friends watch films with subtitles, and, you know, I'm that annoying guy. But it all seems so glamorous to me, and just, I'm not glamorous, maybe that's kind of a weak word, but exciting. You know, I get excited about movies, and the whole idea to sit down and go, okay, we got a 2-year project here, ladies, boys and girls. We're going to make this movie. Because a lot of people in the movie business aren't aware of that. They think people go, oh, well, they weren't doing anything 2 weekends ago, so they knocked out a movie. That ain't how it goes, man. That's a big undertaking. I couldn't do it.
Yeah, especially
it's beyond me.
Especially when you don't have a lot of money. Yeah, in our case, we pitched the film to Camille in December of 2012, and we were working with a different financier in 2013, and we're expecting to shoot in the summer of 2013. Script was a little bit different, project was a little bit bigger, and then that project fell through. So I'd say by the end of that summer, we had just sort of sent everybody home basically and said, you know, we'll let you know if anything happens with this. And then my wife, Karina, who's the producer on the film, we got involved with Mark Patton's documentary, which is Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street. That's also out on Amazon now. And we'd worked on that for a year under a different title. It was called There Is No Jesse. And then we parted ways in November, I think, of 2014. And that's when Roman and Tyler took over the documentary. And they did an excellent job with it. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it, especially if you're a fan of the Nightmare series. It's a deep dive. And you can still see some of my work here. The opening credit sequence is an animated history of Scream Queens from the silent era up to Mark Patton in 1985. And then we did a proof of concept with Camille. We had her in town. We spent a few hours with her one evening just kind of shooting like a test scene to see if we could use that to drum up some interest in it. And it was another 2 years before we found the money to do it. But once the money was in place, it was 30 days, I think, between, okay, you've got the money, and we were shooting. So all of that time, really, like right when the money hit, it was just go time. We didn't really have a pre-production period with rehearsals and special effects tests and costume fitting and all that. We had to conduct a lot of business by email. And when everybody showed up in town a day before, we hit the ground running. But everything was so well planned and so well organized that there was no stress. Everything. I've been involved in a lot of productions, both productions that, you know, have been ours solely, and then productions where I'm working for a client, a commercial shoot, you know, something where you're doing a 30-second spot over the course of a 9-hour day, and it can be really stressful, and you can fall way behind schedule. But surprisingly, shooting a 72-page script in 11 days, we didn't fall behind. None of it was stressful. Everybody got along, and it couldn't have gone any better, honestly.
Oh, that's amazing. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is just a small encapsulation of the hustle that you got to do, the work you got to put in. You know, everybody, the thing is, everybody sees Quentin Tarantino interviews and stuff, and they're like, oh, yeah, you know, I'll just knock this out and blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, I'm flying in G6s dating models. And everybody I know who's done anything, whether it be movies or entertainment or, you know, music, rock and roll, whatever. They work their ass off. You know, there is a lot of work. And part of that work, you just, you know, Samuel really expressed it, isn't necessarily just the filmmaking. It's putting the deal together, baby. You got to have, you know, it's got those wheels got to turn. And so other wheels can turn, you know. That's just part of it. And that can't always be just a smooth ride, you know. People just whip out checks and start writing, in my experience.
Yeah.
Maybe they do.
Yeah, when you go into it, especially when you're looking for money, you know, at an independent level, you don't have the backing of a studio. You don't have accountants, you know, doing everything for you. Our small legal entity that we have that we produce under Chance and Hell Productions had to become a SAG signatory. So we had to go through that entire process.
Oh, wow.
And it means you have to set aside a certain amount for the what they call professional actors, the actors that are in the union. We had two of those and then two more that had done enough films to qualify. So you have to set aside pension and health and savings contributions and their late fees if you don't hit it on time. They want a certain amount of your money set aside for a deposit. And when you have such a small budget, all of that money needs to be on screen. Like, you really can't afford to take, and they were asking for almost a quarter of our budget to just set aside. And we're like, no, that's got to be on screen. We don't have any, but that means a grip truck's not going to be there for a week if you take that money away from us. So a lot of it, you end up doing stuff that, you know, when you're an idealistic young filmmaker and you're like, I just want to point my camera at stuff and get together with my friends, you end up doing a lot of math. You end up doing a lot of scheduling, a lot of planning, a lot of paperwork. I mean, just mountains of paperwork, getting insurance quotes, getting title searches done, getting legal opinions about stuff, clearing music. It's all of that stuff is, that's the iceberg that you don't see below the surface. What's above the surface, that's the fun part. That's the filmmaking part. So.
Right. Well, and it's, you know, I don't think you want, you're like me, you don't want to discourage anybody from doing it, but go into any deal or any prospect or project with a good working knowledge of what you're getting into, man, because, you know, we all know about quicksand. It can, it can, and the cool thing, what Samuel's also, he mentioned briefly, is his wife's the producer on this. So he didn't have to go home to his wife and say, dear, guess what? For the next 6 years, I'm going to be tied up with this. You know, so.
No, she's so that she, when she got involved, she didn't take it. I had the luxury of being able to take paid time off from my job, and some of the other people that I was working with from the world of commercials and stuff, they were also able to step away. But she runs her own business from home, and so a lot of days she would be working in the morning, and then she would go out to set. And then when we got into the second half of the shoot, where we had, I think, 7 days where we were filming exclusively at night, she's working until 2 o'clock in the morning with us. When we strike set, go home, get up in the morning, and then keep working. So she actually didn't take any time off. And it's the kind of thing where when it's, you know, it's a small budget, so you have a situation where there aren't 30 people on the crew. There's about 8 to 10 people on any given day. So that means everybody that's there is wearing multiple hats. So in her case, to say she's the producer, that's the broadest version of that, you know.
She wasn't master, just sitting in an office.
Assistant director,
and stuff.
Costume, you know, all that stuff.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, everybody had that mentality, though. I think because we'd all work together, it's like, look, nobody here is too good to pick up a sandbag or move a C-stand if we need you to. You know, everybody was willing to pitch in and help out, and nobody said, that's not my job, you know?
That's awesome.
It was a good
that
work
is
effort.
So cool. Yeah. And the other thing is, you had people from out of town coming in for this thing, and, you know, those people got to stay somewhere. you know, there is a lot of moving parts to this, is all I'm saying. Well, it's a fantastic film, Cry for the Bad Man. Now, when you wrote this, did you had you had the idea for a while, or what inspired it?
Camille inspired it. There was no idea prior to this, and if Camille wasn't involved, there wouldn't be a movie. It was a meeting between our producer Jerry Rosenberg, myself, Camille, and Karina. Jerry's known Camille for over 40 years, and they think of each other as siblings, brother and sister. And Jerry's sister Sharon and Camille are best friends, and that's all it was. It was just, hey, I know you direct movies. I have a friend who's an actress. And when he said Camille Keaton, I was like, oh, I know who that is. So she came through town to visit Jerry. Yeah, yeah. And we met and we talked about what she was interested in. And you know, she had mentioned stuff like Straw Dogs was one of the references that she came up with.
Okay.
So the story just grew out of pure pragmatism. There was no idea. It was just like, okay, we're going to have a small budget. We're shooting in the South. Camille Keaton's involved. What's her audience like? What's her interest right now? And so a story began to coalesce around, well, it'll be a home invasion with the DNA of a Western siege movie. So that way we can keep everything manageable, mostly single location, mostly in real time, small cast, and not a lot of trick shots or multiple exteriors, multiple locations,
right.
You know, dragging down the budget. So that's what it grew out of. It's just simple conversations about what we would be interested in doing and then what we actually had the resources to do.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. Well, it's fantastic. fantastic. It, you know, it's a great movie. What is it? Was it 1 hour and 30 minutes? Hour and 20 minutes, something like that. I mean,
Hour 15.
I was going to say it didn't seem super long, but you know, I was so into it that it just. I'm like, oh, wow. You know, not, ladies and gentlemen, don't take that wrong. I'm not saying it ended abruptly. You know, I'm like, oh. But what I'm saying is it draws you in. And it was a nice escape. I like this kind of movie, though. I am a kind of crime nut, and I like movies, you know. This is terrible. It's totally coming out wrong. I like corrupt cops and things like – I don't like them. I like them getting their comeuppance. You know, I enjoy that.
Yeah.
Justice, I dig, you know. And, you know, it's – remember, my first movie that I loved when I was a kid was Billy Jack. You know, there ain't no scene more satisfying than when he kicks that guy in the face after telling me he's going to do it. And this movie kind of had that – you know, that spark in it. And I've dug it. Obviously, Camille, experience with firearms, you know, that was pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give anything away in the movie, so I want people to see it. Let me ask you, did you have to get, like, special permits because you had guns and all that stuff in it, or not really? It's Florida. We're all cool.
Kind of. What we did was we planned within our budget. You have to take out production insurance, and they ask a lot of questions about what you're going to be doing on set, whether it be firearms, pyrotechnics, that sort of thing. And your answer to every one of those questions determined your quote. And we simply did not have the money for even squibs, anything that would be an explosive. So what our special effects guy did, and his name's Jay Howell, Jay rigged up pressure-based squibs. So everything, there would be an air compressor off camera, and he would build up the pressure. So anytime there needed to be a gunshot or an explosion of any kind, pushing gore through tubes, basically. And in some cases, in post-production, we would add a muzzle flash or something like that to sell it. There is one shot in the film, and I think it'll be obvious when anybody sees it, where we did use a real gun on a real prop, and what you see is what a 12-gauge shotgun does to this particular body part, because the filming had wrapped, and what we did during production, we did it twice, and the effect was not working. So 2 months after film had wrapped, everybody's gone home, and we're no longer under the umbrella of insurance or the union or anything like that. We simply had Jay take this particular prop out into the woods. We lit it, set up a camera, put up a false wall, recreated the shot basically, but out in the middle of nowhere. And everybody walked away, and he blasted it with a 12 gauge. And what you see on camera is exactly what happens when a 12 gauge hits something. So we did
not
that.
Nice.
The other thing that we had was we have a, yeah, yeah. The other thing that we had for, I think, authenticity was a friend of mine, Trip Turner. He was our technical advisor on it. He works Homeland Security, and he came onto the set. And this guy, you know, he doesn't – it's funny that I'm talking about him as a technical advisor, because for years, like going back to high school, he was always my go-to, like Bruce Campbell. Anytime I wanted to make – if I had a silly idea – for a short film, he was the guinea pig. He would always be in it. But I brought him on as a technical advisor because he handles firearms. And he put Camille at ease. If he could sit and show Camille how to handle something, how to carry something, how to load something, and she didn't have to think about that, then it helped her just perform and not feel like she looked ridiculous holding a firearm. So he was instrumental in getting her to feel comfortable on set around all that stuff. Now, Camille, in real life, don't mess with her. She owns guns and all that. But it was just easy for her to not have to think about, you know, does this look ridiculous? Do I look like Rambo? You know, like I want this to seem real. So he was there to make sure everything was safe.
Yeah.
And I made him give everybody a safety talk ahead and demonstrate that none of the weapons would actually fire, that they were all, in fact, props. I had him just go over everything, their advice, so that they were all at ease. You know, so it was a comfortable working environment around the props.
That's awesome. And, you know, it just goes to show. It goes to show your level of professionalism and whatnot, and taking care of the cast and crew and whatnot, and doing all of that. And, you know, any budding filmmakers out there listening to the podcast, this is the kind of stuff you got to do. You know, it's not just carrying bullhorns around and looking through lenses and a break, being a director and all. That's cool, Samuel. That's cool. Now, I have to ask, this is coming out. We mentioned it's going to be on DVD and digital May 5th from Uncorked Entertainment. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you've all seen Uncorked Entertainment. It's funny, now that we're on lockdown, I scroll through Hulu and Netflix and everything, every other movie, it seems, from Uncorked Entertainment. That's awesome, Samuel, that you're working with them. Get things done.
Yeah, I just watched their. They released that documentary about the Fantastic Four movie that was basically there just to maintain the rights to it. That was a really interesting documentary that they put out.
Oh yeah, I remember that movie. I remember trying to like that movie. I really did.
Yeah, it was Roger Corman's company, I guess, and they basically financed it to fail because they just didn't want to lose the license to it. It was neat. It was an interesting documentary.
That's cool. Hey, now once again, mention your history of Scream Queen film, because I want people to watch that as well. What was that called once again?
Oh, that movie's called Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street, and it's a deep dive into the history of A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, which is sort of the redheaded stepchild of that series, but more specifically the impact that it had on the lead actor, Mark Patton's life. Mark Patton is a now-out gay, HIV-positive actor who left Hollywood largely in part because of the vitriol that followed in the wake of Nightmare on Elm Street 2. He was cursed with this being a wildly successful film and at the same time receiving quite a considerable amount of backlash that affected his personal life and his relationship with his agent and how he was perceived in casting calls after that. So it's about him, it's about his life up to that point, about the film itself, the making of the film, the aftermath of that, and then how, all of that has kind of been reevaluated in recent years and what it's meant to the LGBTQ community specifically, within the horror realm. And it's a really great documentary. It goes further than just, it does a good job of placing it in context for people who were not socially conscious, most of us, I think probably like
right.
My age range, we were all kids when that came out. So if you weren't socially conscious, then it's a good primer on this is what it was like at the time. This was what society thought about AIDS, and this is what society. These were people in the closet that were on television, and in movies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
These were the meetings that were going on behind the scenes. There were people like Mark who were being told, "You can play a gay character in a TV show, but when you do interviews, you tell people you're straight." So there's a lot of that really just puts it in perspective for a modern audience to understand that it doesn't seem like it was that long ago. And certainly right now, everybody's obsessed with 80s nostalgia. This really shows you that, it wasn't all synth pop and neon lights. There was this undercurrent of kind of moral hypocrisy and this ignorance about this disease at the time. So it's great. I highly recommend it. And if you're a fan of Nightmare on Elm Street, there's just no excuse. It's a really good companion piece to Never Sleep Again.
No, awesome. Well, we'll definitely be checking that out. And you're absolutely right. I was just talking to my wife about that, about the whole happened at the same time, but it was something nobody ever talks about now. Because you're right. They all think it's synth pop. The whole satanic panic thing and how Dungeons and Dragons, kids play Dungeons and Dragons, worshiping the devil.
Yep.
All of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, man, you're spot on with that. Very cool. Well, I want to ask you, I know we're up against the time, but I got to ask you before I let you go. Are the gears turning for the next project, and can you talk about it yet?
Sure. I mean, we're always thinking about stuff. The main focus right now is to give this its, you know, proper release, obviously, and see if we make our money back. That's going to be the biggest indicator of whether or not anyone will. We had a small budget. It's manageable.
Right.
And we've gotten enough in minimum guarantees up front to get us very close. So it all depends on how well it does and if we can roll that into something else, because we know after this, it's not like Hollywood's going to be beating down our door. We're independent filmmakers. We're going to have to go and make the case to the next investor. As far as that goes, I haven't really talked about it. I've got a couple of short films that I've been working on that may or may not work as like a proof of concept for the next thing. But I definitely plan on working with a lot of the same people again. And in front of and behind the camera. And we're tooling around with a couple ideas right now. We've got a couple of pitch decks together. And like I said, the selling point is going to be whether or not we can go into one of these meetings and say, look, you know, here's how much it cost to make this last movie and here's how much we made. You know, this is a sure thing. Give us the money.
Right. That's always the fun part. Fun is a check. You know the weird thing, Samuel, have you found that you've been in business long? I used to do a lot of real estate stuff back in the day, and which just bored me to death. But it seemed to me at the time when I was doing it, it was always easier to ask for more money. I got people to give me more, like investors, to get on board with bigger dollars than with smaller dollars. If there's the project, we only need 20 grand for this. Well, man, that was hard, you know. But if you needed 200,000,
yeah,
that was an easier sell. I don't know why you wouldn't think it was that way.
We haven't had that problem yet, but I had early on. I did with our, when we had our relationship with who we thought were going to be our first producing partners, that a similar sentiment came up, and it was this anxiety that when a budget is too high, people get nervous, but when it's too low, they also get nervous because it feels like they're just setting their money on fire. Like you can't possibly make a good movie that we can sell for that little money. So the first time around, we were actually told to inflate the budget. Like what else do you need? Just go crazy. And when it came down to doing it this time, we stayed local and we stayed with people that we knew and had working relationships with. So we presented a budget that was what's considered ultra low budget. So it had the lowest threshold to start getting your money back, getting the investment back. And the only reason we were able to do that was because we had all these resources that we'd worked with from film and television and commercial work who were, we knew their rates and we knew that we could do it in a short amount of time. So we had, we could put those dollars with like, here's the quality that you'll get out of it. So it was an easier sell. And plus I put up some of the money myself and that boosted the confidence of our other investors. Like, well, if you're willing to put your own money into it, and I don't make a lot of money, if you're willing to put your own money into it, then I don't think this will be a waste of time. It was a bigger risk for me to do it than it was for our producer, Catherine, to get financially invested.
I gotcha. It's, you know, people always, I have a good friend of mine that does day trading and you know, stock trading and whatnot. And he's always like, you know, wanting me to get into that world, which I'm so glad I'm not right now. I just don't have, I'd have ulcers, man.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, whenever I talk to a stock person, you know, and they're telling me, oh, what a great deal. I'm like, how much money do you have in? That's my first question. Where are you sitting in this deal? And invariably, they say, well, I don't have any. You know, I'm the facilitator. I'm like, well, you know, you lost me. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. That's cool, man. That is cool. Well, I have a new friend in Jacksonville. I'm very happy about that. I've got a sister-in-law that lives up there. And that's always a fun town to go. So, and vice versa, Samuel. You've got a new friend in South Florida down here in, you know, COVID Grand Central. Wait before you visit.
It might be a while.
That's what I'm saying, man. Oh man, it's terrible. We live like 10 minutes from the beach, and we, you know, people are like, oh, is that hard? I'm like, no. Life. Rather be alive.
Well, you actually, you live
home
closer
anyways.
To Camille then. Yeah.
Oh, is she down this neck
of
the woods?
There. Yeah, she's down there in Pompano.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm right up the road from Pompano, a little town called Deerfield Beach, just south of Boca. Yeah, neighbors. I was just in Pompano Aldi's the other day, getting a paper towel. Yeah, amazing. No, ladies and gentlemen, I wasn't hoarding it. You're only allowed one package for this, but I needed it. Anywho, I made the mistake. Here's the thing. I made the mistake. I don't know if anybody has those trifold paper towels that you get in, like, I don't know, cheap bathrooms, like gas station bathrooms. When all this happened, mm-hmm. I said, I'm going to buy a case of those just in case it goes wrong. Yeah, the missus ain't going for that.
Yeah,
no, that's not going on her. No. I just got married, so I'm learning these things. Anyhow, Samuel, it's great talking to you today. Ladies and gentlemen, cry for the bad man. As I said, I will be posting the link where you can pre-order this. And I'm sure you can pre-order it on, like, iTunes and everything as well. So that's a cool thing. But get the DVD, man. That's what I always tell people. That's cool to have. You'll run into Samuel, like, a horror convention or something, man. Have him sign that. Then you get the signed DVD. Man, it's totally worth it. Good plan.
Yeah,
good
Camille, Camille's doing the festivals just as soon as they open back up, and she has some unique items with her. If, you know, for anybody that ends up really liking the movie, we commissioned some Mondo-styled artwork from an artist, Shane Dubberly. He does all the work for Shriekfest, so people in the horror circuit have probably seen this stuff before. And she's got a couple of lobby cards and some mug shots, actually, of her younger self that we used for the movie. So those are some things that she has exclusively with her that you won't find anywhere else. So if you see her whenever things open back up at one of her tables, check it out.
I got to know the stories on how those came about, but we'll save that for another show. I am interested, though. Gosh darn it. Oh, man, that's cool, man. That is cool. Well, Samuel, keep doing what you're doing. You're real good at it. This movie kicks ass, and I want everybody to watch it. It's out May 5th. Cry for the bad man. You got to watch it. Thanks for doing
thanks
the
so
show,
much,
Samuel.
Man.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for your, yeah, man. Thanks for your patience, too, on this. I know we pushed it back a couple times. I felt bad about that, but you just, you know, you were real cool, and
no
I appreciate
problem, man.
That.
Absolutely. I enjoyed doing it.
Cool. I'll talk to you soon. Ladies and gentlemen, this is going to wrap it up for today's show. We will be back Monday. Matter of fact, next week's kind of crazy. Or not crazy, but it's different. I know we've been doing a lot of film guests the last week or two. And we're doing all music next week. So we've got all different kinds of music and from all over the place, from L.A. to you know, Toronto, Ontario. Got all kinds of musicians coming next week. So it's going to be a music week, and then we're back to movies, which is awesome. So we will see you all on Monday. I know we normally don't do a show on Monday, but it's a weird world we're living in. We are now. So there you go. And also, before you even start emailing me, ladies and gentlemen, I just talked to DJ Miss Monday. We are definitely doing we got our DJ guests lined up for our house music show on Monday the 11th. So that's all in play, and it will be happening this month. Okay, everybody, we will see you later. Have a good one.
This has been pop art painter Jamie Rocks's Pop Rocks Radio Talk Show. It has been executive produced by Jamie Rocks, recorded at his studio in Deerfield Beach in South Florida. All rights reserved by Pop Rocks Limited for broadcast on Blog Talk Radio.
Hej, det här är Hicks från Sverige och ni lyssnar till Pop Rocks Radio med Jamie Rocks.
Blog Talk Radio.